tense now that the time for battle was upon them.
Well and good, Emre thought. We'll need all the bravery we can get.
He stood amidships, watching their fleet of 30 sail ever closer to the king's line of navy ships.
30 against their 73.
Impossible odds already, but there was Chaida's mission to consider as well. She hoped to press deep into the Black Spear fleet and kill Onur, then rally the other tribes to join their cause against the kings. Emre saw her fleet sailing in the opposite direction, 9 ships readying their attack against Onur.
9 bloody ships, he said under his breath. What madness have we given birth to?
It wasn't only that they were facing similar odds against Onur, it was that they had to move quickly if any of this was going to work. Wait too long and the king's ships will have decimated Masid's cadre of ships. The only saving grace was that the kings had spread their fleet thin before the wind dropped. They must have been counting on the 13th tribe to flee, perhaps in many directions at once. Their spread formation would allow them to divert 2 ships to every one that fled and still have ships left over. And if the tribe chose to flee in a tight cluster, the king's faster ships would be able to slow them down while others sailed in behind to finish them off. Hadad stood near Emre with a bright red scarf wrapped around her head. The tail blew in the early morning wind.
This isn't a bad way to die.
I'd prefer not to die at all.
Who doesn't? But the Lord of all things comes for us all.
Wouldn't you rather that day be grand?
She waved her arms wide.
However it ends, this is a day the desert will sing about for 1,000 years.
Perhaps, but if we lose, we'll be painted as the villains. Is that what you want?
Their victors may spin their tails, Emre, but the truth will find its way free. So be bold, be brave. Let the fates see to the rest.
Emre's laugh was cut short when a shout came from below decks. Moments later, 3 crewmen emerged, with 2 familiar faces coming up the ladder behind them, Ramad and Brahma. Frail Lamai trailed behind them, cracking his knuckles with a look like he hoped they would try something. Emre met them near the hatch. Hadad joined them, as did Ariz, Tribe Kadri's young sheikh.
Surely my eyes deceive me, Emre said. Brahma Jidanava and Ramad bloody fucking Amansir. I'd wager my left nut you were both told to leave the desert behind.
Frail Lamai laughed.
Left nut.
Brahma stared at Emre with that same cocksure look he had had when he was young, the one that dared him to say something smart to him again. It had always been a bit of a joke back then. No one had ever mistaken Brahma for a fighter. He had been nothing but a thief, a second-story man. But this was not the same Brahma. The scars over his face spoke of a different man, as did his expression, which reminded Emre of the massive rats that plagued the West End. They were bold, those things. It sent chills down the spine just to look at them. Ramad was different. He was staring at Emre as a man lost in the desert views an oasis. He wanted something, but just then Emre didn't care what. He pulled his knife and advanced on him.
Stop, or Chaida dies. Ramad said quickly.
Emre stayed his hand. He gripped the knife, certain that whatever Ramad had to say would be a lie. But what if it wasn't? He was many things, but he had never struck Emre as a liar.
This had better change my mind. You heard me at the council. Every word of it was true. Before the sun has set, Guldraden will be here. Chaida's in grave danger. But there's a way we might save her.
In the distance, the king's fleet loomed. It wouldn't be long before they met in battle.
How?
Emre said. Ramad's relief was clear, not only in his face, but in the way his words almost tripped over themselves.
You've heard the stories of the Iraq.
how dangerous they are, how angered they become when betrayed.
Emre brandished his kenshar.
We have no time for stories, Lord Amansir.
Ramad tipped his head toward Brahma.
He has an obsidian stone with him. If we break the sapphire that traps Meriem's Erek, it will be freed. But with the stone, he can control it. Can you imagine the devastation it might wreak upon the king's fleet?
Is there a stone?
Emre asked the men holding Brahma. They patted Brahma down and found a pouch inside his trousers. Inside was a disc of black, glass-like obsidian. Emre took it but felt nothing special about it.
How can this free the Erek?
No, Brahma replied. We must break the sapphire around Queen Meriem's neck first.
That,
he nodded toward the obsidian, will make her bend to my will. Emre shook his head.
I don't understand.
Believe me when I say it will work, Brahma said. But even if you choose not to believe me, I'm offering you a powerful tool, one the kings would surely use against you.
This smells, Brahma.
Emre held the stone to the morning light and saw the sun shine through it like a silver coin in sepia ink.
It smells of ox dung and goat piss.
The Erek cannot be controlled.
Perhaps you're right, Brahma replied. But what's your alternative? Run the kings into the sand beneath the skies of your mighty fleet?
He made a show of looking along the line of the tribe's ships.
Setting aside the kings themselves and the blood mage Meriem, they still outnumber you 3-1. They boast the finest ships in the desert, and crews who know them better than you know your own cock. Are you ready to stand against 1,000 spears and 100 ebon blades? Your hope of Cheda and Ishak overcoming Onur in time to turn the tide is a murmur's fancy. None of you will last. Not you, not Masid.
He looked to Haddad.
Not your pretty friend from Malasan, and not Cheder.
Brahma's eyes burned like a demon in the night.
But consider this alternative. I know the Erek, Emre. There's a reason the kings fear them. There's a reason spells were put upon the city walls to keep them out. But imagine, if one were to land in the middle of their precious fleet, we'll likely die either way. But at least we'll have pissed in their soup before we feed the Great Mother. Imagine telling that story to Rafa when you reach the farther fields.
There was a manic glee in Brahma's grin that gave Emre hope. A normal man would quake at what lay before them, but Brahma stood unafraid.
No, not merely unafraid. Eager.
The deck shifted as they crested a shallow dune. In that moment, Emre noticed the crew, truly noticed them. He'd been so intent on the day, ignoring everything else. The ship's crew, her warriors, the old, the children, the wounded. That they had become background, a part of the coming battle instead of what the battle was about. He dearly hoped he could save Cheda, but this battle was about so much more than her. All those on deck and in the rigging stared at him, awaiting his decision, looking to him for orders. He wasn't prepared for this. He wasn't prepared for any of it. Ariz would normally look to his vizier, Ali Budrak, but he didn't this time. He nodded to Emre as if he sensed Emre's indecision.
Whatever you decide, Tribe Kadri will follow.
Emre couldn't lead them blindly into battle. They would lose, not without taking every opportunity to help them first. But gods, the battle was nearly on them already. The Autumn Rose was not a small ship, but the king's galleons dwarfed it.
Do you know which ship they'll be on?
Brahma turned and pointed.
The sapphire is aboard that one, behind the line.
One of the king's ships, sailed a quarter league back from all the others. Several other galleons along the Navy's fleet's grand arc were doing the same. These were the King's ships, Emre understood now, and they'd be well protected from the initial onslaught. How to reach Queen Meriam's, then? The chances that the Rose would be stopped were high, and he couldn't leave it to chance. He turned, looking over the ship's deck, staring out across the quarterdeck to the ships sailing in a line behind them, and then his eyes fell upon the skiff secured to the ship's stern. It struck him then, a crazy idea that seemed crazier by the moment.
"Here!" he called to the flagman. "Hurry! We need to send a message to Maseed."
Chapter 62. Chader could feel the morning's wind gaining in strength. The Amaranth's sails were full, the angle was favourable as well, and the captain was taking full advantage of both. It felt angry, the wind even eager. Surely Thash himself had come to witness the coming battle. Though if so, does that mean he'll grant his favour to the kings? 8 ships followed in the Amaranth's wake. 9 ships in all had been fielded to do battle against the Black Spear fleet. Chader had to laugh, if only to break the tension.
"I don't know if you're listening, Nalame, but we need you. This day of all days, guide our steps."
How she wished she could speak to the goddess directly, but she couldn't. The goddess was in hiding. She glanced over to the bowsprit, where Leora was standing with one hand holding the jib sheet for balance. She was peering at the line of black spear ships, as if her very gaze could peel away the hulls and reveal all that lay within. Her right hand gripped Nalame's staff. Her whole body was quivering. Ishak and Chader had both questioned her about the staff. She admitted that Nalame had given it to her, and that it had been done to even the scales for Eurynde's granting of the worm to Onur. Beyond this, she refused to say more. And Chader had the impression Nalame herself had forbade her from speaking of it. The goddess saw far, Chader knew, and the stakes were clearly larger than this one battle. If it was true Eurynde had granted Onur power over the worm, it meant the other gods were involved, actively involved, in this conflict, and that Nalame must tread with utmost care lest her brothers and sisters find her. Had Isan himself not asked after Nalame? Were the other gods meddling on Toriat as well as the desert? It would explain Nalame's hesitance, but knowing made it no less frustrating. She gazed west and took in the long line of King's ships, some of which were now breaking away from the battle with Emre's small fleet and heading toward their looming conflict with Onur. "We might lose this war before it's truly begun." Sumeya and Melis joined Chader on the foredeck. All 3 had their veils pulled across their faces to ward against the biting wind. Seeing them there, Ishak stepped up to the foredeck. His pepper-grey beard blew over his shoulder as he considered the ships ahead. He seemed content, as if after running his whole life, he was grateful for the chance to stop and turn and strike at the heart of the kings.
"You're strangely calm,"
Sumeya said to him. He ignored her and called to Leora.
"Have you found him?"
Leora shook her head violently.
"No."
The wind tugged strands of hair from the bun atop her head as she shook her head again.
"Now leave me be."
She was crying, Chader realized. She wished desperately to help, but it was too much. She had been pushed to the point of exhaustion.
"Mother, it's time to go."
Ishak tried to lead her away, but she remained, the fingers of her left hand refusing to let go of the jib line.
"It's time to go below. The battle's about to begin."
Bent like a dying tree, she swiveled her head to stare at Ishak.
"I'm not afraid of battle."
Have no fear, Jada said to them both. We'll find him. He'll come to survey the battle sooner or later. Ishak's attention was caught by something along the horizon. Side winding through the sky, like a pennant on the wind, was the sandworm. It flew toward the ships, surely summoned by Anur. The crew tensed. All eyes followed the worm, even as they readied the ship for battle. If it were possible, Leora became more intense, her look more desperate. She scanned the ships ahead and tried to blink away the tears streaming from her bloodshot eyes. Then, without warning, her eyes rolled back in her head and her limbs went slack. Ishak and Chayda caught her and gave her to Frail Lamai, who lifted her as if she weighed nothing. The big man whispered tenderly to her as he carried her away.
It's all right, grandmother. All will be well.
The first of the cat's claws were launched a moment later. The thud of their launching filled the air as dozens more followed, arcing across a pale blue sky to catch the struts of the oncoming ships. Burning pots flew as well, trailing black smoke. The black spear ships responded in kind moments before the amber worm arced down toward the amaranth. A jolt of fear ran through her to see the beast undulating across the pale blue sky, its wings spread wide, the morning sun lancing through the magenta veins that streaked its translucent skin. Terror set Chayda's heart to pounding, but her fear was tempered by relief. She'd reasoned that Onur would send the worm at Ishak's ship. Ishak had agreed and allowed all 17 of the Forsaken, their Asirim, to lie in wait below decks. She could feel their hunger in the hold below. Not yet, she said to them, but the time has nearly come. Closer and closer came the black spear ships. Closer and closer came the worm. Just as it spread its wings and arched its taloned feet forward, Chayda called,
Now, my brethren! Now!
The crew slid back the hatch over the hold, and the Forsaken sprang forth. They wore their white gauze still, refusing to be encumbered by armor. Each carried two long fighting knives. It was strange to see them so. Chayda was used to seeing the Asirim crouched like animals, in pain from the constant torture of serving the kings and the magic the gods had laid upon them. But these were different. Theirs was a righteous purpose, fearsome to behold. The Forsaken had been warned about the worm's terrible breath. The first of the Asirim, who had once been Salsana, lifted her hand and a gout of sand lifted from the desert around the ship. It swirled upward toward the worm and struck as the beast drew breath, blasting its eyes and open maw. The worm swung its head back and forth, the stream of its deadly black spray fouled by its instinctive reaction to protect against the sand that scoured its mouth and throat. Chayda, Ishak, Melis, and Sumeya retreated from the foredeck as the worm landed with a crash. The Forsaken stormed forward, clambered the masts and rigging, and their white forms swarmed over the worm, clawing its fine scales, tearing its skin, ripping the translucent skin of its long wings. The worm clamped its massive jaws over one, bashed another aside as it swung its head around. A fine spray of black liquid issued from its mouth with a strange, rumbling roar. Two of the Forsaken were caught in it, their white raiment blackened and smoked, their flesh liquefied. Yet still they drove their knives into the worm's flesh, tearing wide, gaping holes. Blood streamed from those wounds, steaming where it hit the foredeck. The enemy ships were nearing. Chayda heard something loud clank beneath the ship, and then a thud resounded through the decking. Suddenly the ship was leaning starboard and turning in that direction. Just as she was bringing her ebon blade down against the worm's front leg, she saw something dark and massive looming off the port side. Her mind told her to brace, but it was too late. The prow of a ship crashed into theirs, sending her flying. She lost her sword as she was thrown along the body of the worm and over the port bow. She struck something that burned her left side, and then she was down, sliding against the deck of the other ship. She pulled her knife and twisted, slamming the point into the deck. It bit, scraping against the decking, slowing her down, but not enough. She slammed into something hard, then fell to the main deck of the ship that had struck hers. Suddenly she was among the enemy, fighting, slashing with her knife, trying to hold them off as she looked for her sword. She saw it near the pilot's wheel and fought her way toward it. She reached it at last and was up again, swinging River's daughter in vicious arcs. Among the clashing she heard a whistle, "To me!" It was Sumeya. She was surrounded and barely holding her own. Cheda charged across the deck, screaming, "Lai, lai, lai!" as she went, and fell among the black spear soldiers. As Sumeya's attackers retreated, the two of them stood back to back. She tried to locate Melisse, but couldn't. She worried she'd been thrown to the sand, or worse, that she lay dead on the deck of one of the ships. She and Sumeya fought fiercely, helping one another time and time again. But Cheda knew that the longer they fought, the worse this was for the desert tribes. They were playing into the king's hands. "Up!" Cheda whistled, and Sumeya took her meaning. Together they fought away their attackers, of which there were thankfully few. The crash between ships hadn't been planned, and many now lay stunned, wounded or unconscious. They made their way up along the shrouds as, only 10 paces distant, the worm continued to thrash, half its sinuous body on the black spear ship, half on the amaranth. The Forsaken still fought it, but many were gone or lay unmoving on the deck or the sand. As the worm roared once more, Cheda scanned the ships, many of which had come to a stop. They were surrounded by chaos. Ships sailing on, curving around for another pass. Others halted, some crashed into one another, their skis locked or their sails and booms caught up in the others' rigging. There were clusters of fighting all around. Any plan of attack had been forgotten as men and women from both sides fought with wild abandon. A whistle came, not from Sumeya, but from the sand below. Melisse was there, limping her sword pointing south. Cheda swung her gaze in that direction and saw what Melisse had. A ship, a 3-masted schooner, with something massive standing on its deck. It was hard to get a gauge on it, as distant as it was, but it was easily twice the size of a man and was tearing at the ship's deck, ripping up boards and flinging them away as arrows came biting in from all directions. "Honor is there," Cheda said. "So is the Erek," Sumeya replied. Cheda shrugged and grabbed a rigging line. "So it is," she said, knowing that everything Ramad had said was true. The Erek Guldrathan had come for Hamzakir, who was surely on the very same ship, and it had been lured by Cheda's own blood. Her throat tightened at the thought of what it would do when it had finished with Hamzakir.
"It demanded your blood," Ramad had said.
"Baki's bright hammer, the strength of the thing." It was deeper into the ship, killing any foolish enough to come near. "But what is there to do about it?" Cheda thought. "If the Lord of all things has come for me, so be it." She slid along the rigging line, somersaulting as she neared the ship's edge and rolling on the sand to break her fall. With the roar of battle still spreading around them, Sumeya landed next to her. Melisse approached, limping, but seemed ready as ever to swing a sword. Before Cheda could take another step, Sumeya grabbed Cheda's arm and turned her around.
There's no need for you to go nearer a beast such as that. Not when we know it thirsts for your blood. Remain with your tribe. Let me and Melisse find Honor.
Chayda motioned toward the distant ship.
Look at it, Sumeya. If it finishes with Hamzak here, it will surely come for me, and there's nothing we can do about that. But we might take Honor. We can kill him for all he's done to Zayid and 1,000 others in his time walking the desert.
Sumeya hesitated, but Chayda refused to wait. She began running toward the ship where the Arek had clawed its way to the deck below. Without looking, the beast lashed its tails at a woman who was charging with a spear held high in both hands. One tail batted the spear aside, while the other caught her across the throat. She was thrown over the far side of the ship as Guldrathan tore a massive beam from the deck. It was as large as a skiff, but the Arek launched it into the air toward a group of black spear archers as if it were kindling. The archers were crushed, and the Arek dropped down into the hole it had created. Much of it was lost from view as it tore deeper and deeper into the ship, like a bone crusher tearing into a hapless hare's den. In that moment, the shutters of the captain's cabin at the rear of the ship were thrown wide. An ornate spear was tossed down to the sand, and Honor's bulky frame levered itself out to fall unceremoniously to the sand, landing just beside the spear. Using the spear to support himself, Honor propped himself up. He looked as though he were drunk as he lumbered forward, looking wild-eyed over his shoulder at the ship he had just escaped. A moment later, he pulled up as he spotted Chayda, Melisse and Sumeya. He had his spear at the ready, but appeared so weak he could hardly hold it. Behind him, another form dropped from the same cabin window. He sprinted after Honor, but then pulled up as he saw Chayda and the others. It was Hamzakir, Chayda realized. Blood ran from a cut on his forehead and stained his golden clothes. Like Honor, he seemed concerned by the sudden presence of a trio of blade maidens standing before him, but before he could speak, a great roar came from behind him. Hamzakir turned, petrified, as the Arek lifted itself from the hole it had torn in the ship and leapt down to the sand. With his landing came a deep booming sound that rose above the chaos of the battle. Chayda felt it in her chest. The Arek charged straight for Hamzakir. The blood mage ran, his eyes crazed with fear.
"Save me!"
he called to Honor, stumbling toward him. Honor looked as if he were considering it, but as Hamzakir came close, he brought the butt of his spear up in a sharp cross-strike to the side of Hamzakir's head. As Hamzakir fell, stunned, Honor backed away as if a leper lay before him. Hamzakir reached his knees, clasped his hands, and stared at the sky.
"Julathan, save me!"
But the silver goddess was deaf to his pleas. The ebony-skinned beast fell upon him and lifted him into the air. The pair of them looked like a mirage, a twisted reflection of father and child. Hamzakir screamed, arms flailing, legs kicking against the beast's face and horns as the Arek's thumbs drove into the center of his chest. Hamzakir's ribcage was pierced and torn wide. The glistening ropes of his intestines spilled to the sand, while other viscera shook within the rapidly widening cavity. A moment later, Hamzakir's screams were cut short, though his limbs continued to quiver like a man stricken with palsy.
"Now take her!"
Honor bellowed at the beast. He was pointing his spear at Chayda.
"Take her, Guldrathan, as was promised."
Chapter 63. Brahma sat in the center of a skiff as it flew across the sand. The mast and sail were laid down, still held in their clamps. The sails would not be needed. They were only going to have one chance at this. Brahma held a bow in one hand, the quiver resting in the crook, where hull met thwart, bristled with arrows, though he doubted he'd have time to loose more than one. And in any case, his responsibility lay not in his skill with a bow, which was moderate at best, but in the two items on the boards between his feet. At first glance, it looked like a single mound of rope, but closer examination revealed two separate implements, one a coil of thick silk rope, to one end of which was tied a triple-hooked iron grapnel. The second, lying beneath, was a boarding net woven like a ship's shroud, with small hooks secured along one side. Emre was at the front, one knee on the forward thwart holding an axe. The wind whipped the free strands of his long, braided hair. Ramad sat at the tiller, guiding them as they trailed the two large ships that towered ahead of them. The Kadri ship, Autumn Rose, and the Errant, Masid's ship. The wind was gusting, and the sails of both ships were full. The ships sailed so near one another it looked as though their hulls would strike, or that their sails and rigging would get caught, but their pilots were masterful. They worked the wheels, guiding the ships carefully over the sand as they sped toward the dark line of navy ships ahead. A thick rope hawser was looped through a hook at the front of the skiff. The hawser trailed ahead of the skiff, up and over the gunwales of both the Autumn Rose and the Errant. The hawser's ends were looped around each ship's foremast, effectively towing the skiff along the sands, while at the same time, because the ships sailed so close to one another, hiding them from view. It was necessary. If the king's crew worked out what they were about to do, their gambit would be over before it began. A horn blew on the Errant, a sound as bright as the sunrise. It was a call to all the ships trailing behind to prepare for battle, but also a signal for the skiff to be ready. Emre pointed across the bow.
"Steady now! Watch the rise there! I see it!"
Ramad adjusted the skiff's course to avoid the steep dip along windward side of the misshapen dune. Beyond the Rose and the Errant, the king's ships were only a quarter league away, then an eighth league, and still the king's ships held their course. Brahma's heart was beating like a racing Akala's when another horn finally blew, loud and long and clear. The Rose and the Errant immediately adjusted course, their lines diverging. The trailing ships began to drift into two separate columns as well. A gambit to confuse the king's ships and mask what was about to happen. As the hulls of the Rose and Errant drifted farther and farther apart, the hawser was drawn tighter and the skiff accelerated, adding to its already considerable speed. Faster and faster it went, the wind whipping Brahma's hair against his face. The ride became bumpier as the Ramad guided them steadily over the sand. Bells rang on the king's massive galleons looming ahead. They adjusted course as well. Flame pots flew from both lines of ships, arching across a robin's egg sky. Imperfect lines of black smoke trailed behind. Arrows flew, countless dark, fletched shafts streaked between the ships. They looked like the swarms of insects that played the hada in the thick of spring. The hawser drew tighter and tighter. Emre raised his axe, preparing to bring it down at just the right moment. But gods, dead ahead, one of the king's galleons, having realized the path between the Rose and the Errant was the only way to avoid a collision with either ship, was now hurtling directly toward them. A maiden stood near the galleon's bowsprit. Brahma thought he heard a series of sharp whistles, at which point two more maidens joined her, each bearing a bow with arrow nocked. The hawser went tight. Brahma heard a creaking sound as it stretched and the front of the skiff lifted from the sand. With a sharp grunt Emery brought the axe down. By then the skiff was moving so fast, Brahma was certain they'd turn and tip and be flung free. But Ramad guided them with uncanny instincts between the oncoming galleon's long skimwood skis. Brahma loosed an arrow at the maidens, managing nothing more than making the one who'd whistled twist from its path. The other two drew their bowstrings and let fly. One arrow grazed Brahma's thigh and thudded into the skiff's hull. The other flew just past his head. As the pain in his leg began to register, he heard a grunt behind him. He turned to see Ramad's right forearm shot straight through, pinning him to the tiller itself. His left arm was looped through a heavy shield he was holding at the ready, but the maiden's aim had been sure enough to slip past the shield's edge. Brahma tried to reach for the arrow, but abandoned the plan when Ramad growled,
"Leave it!"
His eyes fixed determinedly ahead. "Just get the bloody grapnel ready." Before the maidens could shoot again, the skiff hurtled beneath the galleon's hull. Emre, Brahma and Ramad all ducked to avoid having their heads clipped by the ship's keel. The sound of battle dimmed, replaced by the sharp hissing of the galleon's great skis. The rudder clipped the rear of the skiff, jolting them, but then they were flying out onto open sand once more. Brahma handed Emre the bow and took up the grapnel. They were headed straight for the capital ship behind the lines now, King Kiral's ship. The ship where Queen Meriem was hiding, and where Brahma was certain Rumayesh's sapphire hung around her neck. Brahma marvelled at Emre's skill with a bow. The man was a wizard. He'd taken up four arrows between the knuckles of his right hand. As the three maidens reappeared at the ship's stern behind them, he released one, then another, and another, all four flying in such tight sequence the maidens hardly had time to duck before the next was on them. He appeared to catch one in the neck with the fourth arrow. She dropped from sight and wasn't seen again. The other two, however, lifted their bows and aimed while Emre grabbed more arrows. Ramad had lifted the heavy shield onto the thwart and ducked behind it just in time. Two arrows crashed into it. Both would have taken him in the back. His right arm, the arrow still driven through the meat, was bleeding badly now.
"It'll come fast," he said through gritted teeth,
his gaze guiding Brahma to the king's galleon ahead. Indeed, despite losing some speed, they were still hurtling forward. The galleon was adjusting course, perhaps trying to avoid the skiff, but Ramad adjusted right along with them. Brahma stood. He let the rope out and began spinning the grapnel. A dozen silver spears stood along the galleon's starboard side, most with bows at the ready. Emre loosed a volley of arrows, all four striking home. Then the spears let fly. Amidst streaking arrows, Brahma saw a wisp of a woman in a rusty red dress, standing by the king's soldiers. Queen Meriem. She was staring at the skiff with eyes that glinted in the sunken hollows of her face.
"You shouldn't have come, brother!"
she shouted. Ramad ignored her as the galleon adjusted course so that its starboard ski headed straight for them. The ship's captain was hoping the ship itself could do the work of the silver spears for them. But Ramad, grimacing, his breath coming in sharp huffs, pushed at the tiller until they were running alongside the galleon again. As the spears, and now a pair of maidens, fired straight down at them, Brahma spun the grapnel one last time and flung it toward the rearmost shroud.
"It's caught!"
Brahma called.
"Turn! Turn, turn!"
Ramad swung wide, then brought the line of the skiff about, curving them around so that they came nearer and nearer to the galleon's line of sail. The rope coiled out, then snapped tight. The skiff curved around the galleon's stern. The rope creaked, and Meriem appeared at the aft gunwales, her hand lifted high, and launched a ball of bright fire at the skiff. It flew straight for them, But as it neared, it diminished and flew off course, striking the sand to their starboard side. A thundering boom accompanied a geyser of sand lifting high into the air, but Brahma was paying more attention to Ramad. His free left hand was lifted, palm facing outward. Sweat had gathered on his brow. He'd said he could protect them from Meriem, but Brahma hadn't really believed him until now. Another tight ball of fire came streaking in, but it was off target. The skiff was moving so swiftly it swung around to the galleon's port side. From there, Brahma and Emery both hurled the net up and across the gunwales. Quickly they leapt upon it, then turned to help Ramad. Abandoning the tiller, Ramad snapped the arrow and yanked his arm free. Just as the skiff was beginning to pull away, he leapt across the gunwale to land on the lower portion of the net. He groaned and his left arm slipped free, but Brahma held him tight by his shirt until he could begin climbing, right behind Emre and Brahma. Brahma and Emre reached the quarterdeck a moment later and engaged the squad of silver spears who met them, but Brahma was already on the lookout for Meriem. Everything depended on her, or rather on his ability to take the sapphire from her. He could feel her somewhere forward. Behind him, Ramad reached the deck. The three of them fought viciously, keeping the silver spears away, but then several of the spears retreated, making room for the blade maidens in their black battle dresses. That was when Brahma saw Meriem, climbing the stairs to the quarterdeck. King Kiral stood beside her, with a bright two-handed shamshir in his grasp. The necklace hung from Meriem's throat, the facets of the sapphire glinting in the sun. In that moment, Emre managed to cut down one of the silver spears between them, and Brahma saw his chance. He rushed toward Meriem, shouldering aside the last silver spear between them, but he had not taken two strides before a figure in black came rushing in from his right. He turned in time to see the blade maiden, her ebon blade blurring toward him. He felt something burn along his shoulder and continue down his side, through his ribs. He fell to his knees, a sensation more painful than he had ever experienced with Rumayesh boiling the whole of his right side. He felt a boot on his back, which shoved him forward as something tugged at his insides. He collapsed to the deck. Above, yards of canvas glowed the colour of lemon pith. Beyond them, the sky burst in a brilliance of blue. The dark, scratched wood of the bulwark stood like a curtain reaching down toward the deck boards. As footsteps thudded loudly in his ears, a warm sensation travelled along his left side. A stream of red crept across the deck boards, thin at first. It widened. A stream became a river, became a lake.
"You've come, as I knew you would."
He wanted to smile, but found it impossible. Something gurgled in his chest as he whispered,
"I've arrived a dying man."
"Dying?"
Rumayesh said.
"Your eyes are lit with life."
"I yearn for life, yes. But I'm failing."
"No, Brahma,"
she said in honeyed tones.
"Not with the gifts I've bestowed. It would take more than this to carry you to the farther shores."
He blinked, heard muffled words. He had trouble understanding what she was saying at first. Yes, she had given him the ability to heal, but there were secrets hidden in her words. Suddenly his feelings about her made sense. How he yearned for her, how he ached, how he felt as though he could not be complete without her.
"Part of you,"
he began.
"A shard of your soul lies within me."
"It does."
More began to come clear.
"You were trying to free yourself. Since the moment I was trapped within the sapphire, Brahma, it merely took me a while to find the way out. Through me.
Through you."
He wanted to laugh. He wanted to cry. For so long he had thought he was the master. But for years, Rumayesh had been working him like clay, forming him into an image that pleased her. Had she not been stolen away by Ramad for Meriem's purposes, he wondered how long it would have been before she had him.
"Not long," she replied.
"Not long." He had been under her spell for months, a time that seemed impossibly distant, impossibly long. And he had nearly given himself to her again.
"It won't be the same," she promised. "I came to know you, Brahma, and you came to know me. We were not one, but had begun walking that path with one another. Can you say it wasn't so?"
There was no denying it. With the sort of perspective that years granted, it was clear as the rising moons. Footsteps approached. A dress dyed in rust passed before him, as did a man wearing fine leather boots and a rich caftan.
"Come, do you not believe me now? How much we might do together? We can, Brahma, if you but stand, if you but free me."
In the end, there was no refusing her. He could no more deny her than he could will his heart to stop beating. The pain it brought on was excruciating, but he rolled to one side and reached for the pouch where he had secreted away the obsidian stone, the one he had used to give Rumayesh her new name.
"You won't need it," Rumayesh said. "I've changed."
Good, Brahma thought. His fingers were shaking too terribly for such delicate movements in any case. He turned his head and saw Ramad being held by two silver spears, Meriem standing before him. He had a deep gash along his forehead, and poor Emre grunted and twisted on the deck like a wild badger. He quieted when one of the maidens crouched and crashed the hilt of her ebon blade against the side of his head. Someone spoke. It sounded like burbling water. Immediately after, they wrestled Emre to his feet. Ramad stared straight at Meriem, the woman in the red dress. Emre was forced to do so, the maiden grabbing a hunk of his long black hair and lifting his head until he was staring drowsy-eyed at the queen. Brahma tried pushing himself up, but his right hand slipped on the blood. He tried again, managed to make it to his knees. So many were gathered, surely they would spot him.
"Their eyes are on the queen," Rumayesh whispered. "Only the queen."
He pushed himself up. How his legs shook. He felt like a pile of leaves stacked high, ready to tip the moment the next breeze struck. But he managed it at last, and saw that Rumayesh had spoken the truth. Every single person standing on the deck, 2 dozen souls, couldn't seem to take their eyes from the queen. It was Rumayesh's doing.
"In truth," Meriem was saying to Ramad, "I wish you'd fled. I wish you'd returned home. I might have let you live if you'd been willing to remain in Via Rosa and tend to your estate. But no. You were always so stubborn."
Brahma managed to step forward. He felt something shift inside him, heard a crunching sound, and tried not to think what it meant. A bloody, gruesome smile broke across Ramad's face.
"Not so long ago, you appreciated my stubborn streak."
Brahma took another step, concentrating on reaching Meriem. He could see the chain around her neck, only 2 steps away now, but gods, how it pained him to move. A furnace burned along his right side, turning him to ash.
"I did once," Meriem replied, "but all things come to an end."
He took one more quavering step and slipped his knife free from its sheath. As Meriem raised her hand, One of the maidens shouted,
"Queen Mariam!"
The maiden had somehow broken the spell, but he was so focused on Mariam he hardly spared her a glance. The maiden was looking straight at him, breaking away from Emre's side. Brahma lunged, grabbed the chain, and fell. The chain snapped. Something heavy thudded to the deck. The amulet. Dear gods, the amulet. Only an arm's reach away. Mariam's rusty red dress slid aside. The maiden loomed, lifting her ebon blade high. Crying out in pain, Brahma crawled forward, brought the knife up and drove it down with all his might. The point struck the center of the amulet. Brahma felt it give. Tiny shards bit into his hands and face as the gem shattered. He was blown back, caught in a gale stronger than the desert's fierce autumn sandstorms. He rolled away, trying to shield himself from the pain, and was blown farther still. The air all about was a roar, unlike anything he had ever heard. A storm of such intensity that it felt like the first gods had returned to sunder the desert they'd left behind. The wind swept him down the stairs to the main deck. He landed hard and slid along until he came to a stop facing the quarterdeck. Behind him, near the main mast, a tight swirl of dust and sand was forming. The soldiers and maidens had all backed away, Emre and Ramad with them. Mariam and King Kiral had both fallen. They stared aghast at the dark form within the maelstrom. The wind ebbed, blowing outward in a sudden gust, and Rumayesh stepped forward. Kiral was a tall man, but the Arek towered over him. Her three tails swished hypnotically behind her. A crown of thorns adorned her head, from which two ram's horns swept up and curled behind her head. Ebony skin shimmered in the morning sunlight, which grew brighter as the dust and sand drifted on the day's considerable wind. It was her eyes, however, that drew one's attention. They were filled with little save malice and wrath and vengeance. When combined with the amused smile on her lips, it sent a chill deep inside Brahma. He had known what Rumayesh's return would mean for Mariam and her accomplices, but that didn't mean he wanted to see it played out. As Rumayesh took her first step onto the quarterdeck, Mariam leapt over the side of the ship. Kiral came right after. They arced down toward the sand, and where they struck, massive explosions followed. Sand flew outward from the twin points of impact. Thoom, thoom. When the sand settled, there was no sign of them, in either of the large cone-shaped craters. For several breaths, Rumayesh merely stared, her black-crowned head swiveling as the ship sailed on. Everyone else, all across the decks, in the rigging, the soldiers, the crew, the pilot, the maidens, even Emre and Ramad, were silent and unmoving. They stared with wide eyes at the towering Arek before them. None moved to stand against her. None dared take a step for fear of drawing her attention. Rumayesh turned to face Brahma. As she stalked forward, footsteps booming over the deck, Brahma managed to sit on the foredeck stairs. The smile on Rumayesh's face was something he could hardly bear to look at. He had worked long and hard to forget the memories it dredged up, but he had been fooling himself all along. They had not been forgotten. They were merely hidden, lurking, waiting to step into the light once more. His heart beat madly. His breath came so strongly his throat burned from it. It felt as though his chest was ready to burst. But then Rumayesh waved one taloned hand.
"No more," she declared.
And just like that, the nightmares receded, faded until they were more like daydreams, half-remembered and impotent.
Not while we are one.
Brahma's mind was too muddled to discern if that was a threat of some sort, but the pain within him was easing at last. Only then did he realize that they'd sailed beyond the battle line. The bulk of the fighting was taking place behind the ship, while ahead, off the starboard bow, a second battle raged. His purpose here slowly returned to him.
Gudrathan is coming,
Brahma said.
Gudrathan, my brethren has already arrived,
Rumayesh corrected. Brahma lifted his arm and pointed toward the second line of battle.
Save them! Save Chaitar and the others!
Rumayesh smiled a wicked smile.
You need not worry over them,
she waved her hand to Ramad and Emre.
Nor these. We may do whatever you desire. Return to Sharakai and live the life of a king. Sail the desert. Feast among the tribes. Or go to Malasan and dine in the halls of their mad king. We might dance on the night of 1,000 lanterns in Tzitzian, or visit the grasslands of Kundun, where the smell of the wind, just before a storm strikes the hills, renews the spirit. All that we can do, she said, and leave your pain behind. Leave them behind, you mean?
Brahma said, nodding toward Ramad and Emre.
What care have you for them? The great Shangazi is worth fighting for. The great Shangazi will be here whether you fight for it or not. Save them,
Brahma repeated.
Save Chaitar from Gudrathan, and you'll save the rest.
Rumayesh paused, her tails whipped behind her in rhythms of three. When she spoke again, a distinct wryness tinted the low timbre of her voice.
Very well, my master.
Before Brahma knew what was happening, Rumayesh's form burst into 1,000 black beetles. They buzzed around him. They bore him into the air. He heard shouts of surprise through the deafening, chittering sound, but could spare no thought for others. He shut his eyes as he felt something shift. It felt as if the world itself were altering in some unknowable way. When the clatter of the beetle's wings receded and he dared open his eyes, he found himself in the skiff once more. It still trailed behind the galleon on the rope he had launched over the gunwales earlier. Ramad and Emre were there as well. All three of them were plagued by the black beetles, but in a moment the swarm was lifting up and away and speeding toward the battle in the distance.
Cut the line,
Brahma said.
Quickly!
Emre already had his knife out. He used it to cut them free. As the galleon drifted away, those standing at the gunwales watched them with open mouths and widened eyes. Not a single one still holding a bow made to knock an arrow. Soon their skiff had come to a sighing halt. The galleon's looming profile and the swarming cloud of beetles both dwindled along two divergent paths. Without another word, the three of them set about the task of setting the mast and lifting the sail. Chapter 64. Over the sand, Gudrathan stalked Chaitar. Onur watched, gleeful as a boy on Bet Rival. A scattering of his warriors, who had been separated when he'd fled the ship, were approaching from behind. Chaitar knew she had only moments to act before Gudrathan was on her, and she refused to flee. It was vital to take Onur down before Gudrathan could reach her. She sprinted left, whistling for Melisse and Sumer to flank her as she went. She wanted to warn them not to attack Onur, not yet, but the chance that he would decipher her instructions was too great. Gudrathan moved faster now, a black laugher charging its prey. As she'd hoped, it adjusted course as she ran, its path bringing it closer and closer to Honor.